Michael Nicholson, Reel 10.
The Syrians had determined to kind of stop any further advance by the Israelis towards Damascus. It sent this huge convoy from Sassa to Kenetra. Other than that very first convoy I saw of the Israelis in the Sinai, it was the biggest convoy that we'd seen. And but the Israelis knew about it, and they'd planned this ambush, this awful, this terrible ambush from the air. The Syrians had to cross a bridge, and unknown to them, the Israeli phantoms were watching from the air. And when they got close enough, a single phantom came in and took the bridge out, bombed the bridge. So the convoy was stuck in the desert. It's very hard to turn around. Some of those roads are built high, and there they were trapped, stationary. And immediately, a squadron of phantoms came in, and they just picked off this convoy. They just strafed it, bombed it, and one by one, these lorries were blown up, and men couldn't go anywhere. And by the time we got there, it was just a huge, long line of charred vehicles, charred corpses, the most awful sight here. You know, drivers sitting in their cabs, incinerated, and still wearing their helmets. Some of them grinning at you, because, you know, once the skin is gone, all you see is the teeth, and you know, this awful sight of a helmet and a skull and the teeth grinning at you and an incinerated body. It was the most callous thing, of course, but then war is callous. It was absolutely dreadful, absolutely dreadful. And once we filmed it, as best we could. And as we were leaving, Don McCullen came up. Don was one of my generation's greatest war photographers. And he had sad news that just up the road, he'd been filming with Nick Tomlin, who worked for the Sunday Times, great journalist, good buddy. And Nick had also been hit by a wire-guided rocket had hit his car and blown up the car and killed him. Poor old Don was very upset. There you are. After what we'd seen that day, the death of Nick seemed very secondary. Terrible thing to say, but it's true. There was... Having survived the war, especially the two MiG attacks on us, it was towards the end of the war, I think, that I came as close as ever, as I ever had been in that war, and as close as I had been in many wars to kind of being wiped out. We were with a tank squadron advancing beyond the Barlev line down towards the canal itself. This was the final throes of the war, and the final and successful attempt to push the Egyptians back across the canal into Egypt, where they were surrounded by the Israelis. And we were this tank squadron, and there were Centurion tanks, British Centurion tanks. One thing about this, by the way, they were British, and once the war began, our Prime Minister then, Edward Heath, decided in his wisdom, if such a word could ever be applied to Edward Heath, that he would not supply spares to these Centurions. It's rather bizarre, isn't it? You sell weapons of war in times of peace, but then when war breaks out, you refuse to continue supplying weapons of war, even spares. So the Israelis couldn't get spare parts for their Centurion tanks. But, you know, typical of Israeli ingenuity, what they were doing was were forming kind of knacker's yards in the desert or in the Golan, in which they were repairing tanks, and there was the boast that they could make one new tank out of six damaged tanks. And I saw it happening. I mean, quite astonishing. In the middle of nowhere, they were just dismembering these tanks and building a new one out of them. They also had a man to hose out the inside of these tanks. Usually they were full of dead bodies and bits and pieces of human beings. And this poor man's job was to go in there with a hose pipe and just hose out all the bones and blood. So these Israeli soldiers would spit out the word heath in much the same kind of venomous way as they would spit out the word sadat. You know? Heath was not a popular man then. Not that he's ever been popular anywhere, I think. However, we were with the Centurion tanks. Now, the Centurion tank was used by the Israelis because it has this gyroscopic gun. So whatever the terrain, as the tank goes up and down over bad, the gun is supposed to keep level, so you can actually fire on the move. But such was the terrain down towards the canal that these sand dunes were like kind of mini mountains, and time the gyro had gone one way, the tank was going in another. So it was impossible to fire on the move, which meant that they would take big casualties from the Egyptian artillery. So what the Israelis did was to put in among the tanks armoured personnel carriers, which are open, and put mortars in the armoured personnel carriers. And so that the mortars, of course, were not affected. They can just fire up into the air, as you know, up and in down. And they would provide the cover. They would be the kind of advance guard shelling the Egyptian artillery as the Centurions advanced. Now, I was in one of the APCs, and by sheer bad luck, I was separated from my crew. They were in another. There were six of us, and we were being driven by a young lieutenant who apparently was determined, you know, to get the highest military award by leading the tanks into battle, because it turned out that we were almost the lead vehicle. And we were getting it very bad. I mean, these things were solid chunks of metal, but you know, every time a shell landed near us, it kind of shook, and we were getting smothered in sand. And by the look on the faces of the Israeli soldiers in the tank, including a regular sergeant who was as tough as they come, I could tell that, you know, this was it. People started praying. They were shouting at the lieutenant to slow down, but he was just manic. And I was actually helping in the mortars too. I was, you know, pulling them out of the cases and passing them along. And these things make the most enormous din, especially inside a closed APC. So, you know, you pull out the shell, pass it, it drops. You hands over your ears, you close your eyes and wait for the explosion. And it just went on. So I actually became part of the gun crew. I thought, this is the way to go, I suppose. If you're a war correspondent, what better way to go? I wonder if they'll record this in your obituary, if anyone will ever know. And then suddenly, by the sheer bit of luck, suddenly we stopped. And somebody peered above a parapet and said, oh, the tank's been hit. They're bringing a wounded man to us. And sure enough, the armour-plated doors open. And this poor man was brought in and shoved along the floor, very badly smashed. His helmet was split open, and I could see white as well as red. So I could see his brain. Our job was in taking back to the field hospital, closer to one of the bunkers on the Barlev. And we thought, thank God, thank God, thank God, you know. We're out of it. Of course, the lieutenant was furious. He wanted to carry on with this heroic assault on the Egyptians. But we were absolutely delighted, and we turned around and went back. And, you know, and as we could hear the shelling getting further and further from us, the safer we felt. But every now and again, the lieutenant was saying, is he still alive? Is he still alive? Because, you know, if the guy was dead, we would just, right, we'd just turn around and go back into the war again. And this wounded man started to claw himself, I remember. He was clawing his chest and his face. And so the corporal on the other side grabbed his hand and beckoned me to grab the other, so I grabbed the other hand and held it tight. Astonishing strength in a dying man. And this lieutenant kept shouting, is he still okay? Is he still alive? And we were saying, yes, yes, yes. And suddenly the hand I was holding went limp, and I looked across the corporal, and he looked at me, and we both knew that he was dead. But every time the lieutenant kept shouting, is he still? And we kept saying, yes, 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 hurry, hurry. And then we held the dead man's hand until we got back to the field, the bunker. So that poor dead man saved at least six lives, I think. And that really was the end of the war for me, because we didn't go back. The time that we'd got back to the Barlev, that evening, the Egyptians surrendered. The war was over. We heard it on BBC World Service. We were sitting inside a bunker. One of the tank commanders was there. And I was surprised, because we heard it on, you know, Lily Bolero, BBC World Service. And I expected the Israelis, because there's quite a few crews inside this bunker, I quite expect them to kind of cheer and clap. I couldn't make out why they weren't celebrating their victory. And this tank commander got up. I remember a very, very tall man, very almost a feet looking, very slender, got up, and he went to the door of the bunker, the opening, and looked out across the Sinai. It was a brilliant evening. I remember the tanks were out there, all silent, in no particular order. These great massive things with their guns still pointing west. Brilliant night. And this lieutenant said to me, he lit a cigarette, offered me one. He said, "You must. I know what you're thinking. You're wondering why we aren't cheering." And I said, "That's exactly what I was wondering." He said, "Well, we've been to war three times against the Arabs." And he said, "Each time it's got harder." He said, "I lost my son, one of my two sons, in the Six-Day War, and I was quite expecting the Syrians or the Egyptians to kill my second son in this." He said, "We're not celebrating, because if there's another war, we won't win it." He said, "I've never seen the Arabs fight the way they fought this time. I don't think we could ever win another war. That's why we're not cheering." And off he walked into the desert. It was a very sad ending to a war. I thought it should have been a happy ending, as if wars can never have a happy ending. But they didn't celebrate. And of course, it lasted 17 days. And that was the end of my war in Yom Kippur.
Mm-hmm. Well, was it a very close thing? I mean, you were really very in with the fighting, weren't
no,
you?
No, it wasn't a close thing, no. I mean, it was... The Israelis are fierce fighters, and I don't think that once the Egyptians had been pushed back across the Nile, once their third army had been surrounded... the heart had gone out of it. And once the Egyptians had capitulated, there's no way the Syrians had the heart to carry on, or even the armour to carry on. And King Hussein of Jordan was playing a very strange game, and I think he was waiting for the first excuse to kind of wave the white flag too and pull back. No, I think once Egyptians were across, that was it. I don't think it was ever a close run thing. It was in the first few hours, I think. But as I said earlier, had the Israelis not been prepared for something, because they knew something was coming, then I think the Syrians would have moved into the Golan, and once they were up there, they would have been very hard to budge.
Israelis got organised. Did you actually have press briefings after the initial stages?
Yes, we had press briefings, and of course we had escort officers wherever we went. As I said earlier, once the initial panic had subsided and they started to gather together and get more in control, you weren't allowed to go anywhere without an escort officer. And of course, everything you sent out was censored. Censorship was very strict. The minder or the escort officer would only take you places that he was allowed to take you, and you weren't allowed to leave him. And when you came back with your film, there was a second censor sitting by the editing suite, editing machine, and you could only send out to London what he agreed should be sent out. And just in case you tried to trick them, they would go into the satellite feed point with their finger on the button. So if anything they saw was wrong, they would press the button and stop the feed. I remember on one occasion, There was a shot of shells being loaded into a lorry or onto a battery, and he said, "No, you can't use that." I said, "Well, come on, it's just shells. We've shown thousands of shells." He says, "You can't use those shells." And of course, I realised why later is that they were coloured. I think they were coloured. The tips were coloured purple or blue. I think it was purple, and that indicated they were phosphorus shells, which of course are banned by international agreement. Devastating shells, but the Israelis were using them. And that's why he wouldn't let me use that. But no, very strict censorship, very fair censorship. And they worked on the assumption on the principle, which I think is the only way you can control the press or should control the press, and that is you had reasonable access. They let you go to most of the places you wanted to go to, and only after that did they decide what you could and couldn't use. Unlike the British censorship during the Falklands and the Gulf War, where they simply restricted you in every way. You could only go to places. Most of the places you didn't really want to go, but allow people to film what they want to film, and then when it comes back you decide what they should show. That's not always possible, of course. It was possible in the Falklands, it was possible in the Gulf, because in both those wars the journalist is very much a prisoner of the military. Not all wars are like that, of course. Bosnia was a war where you had pretty great freedom of movement, and so you couldn't possibly have had a minder. But the Israelis were pretty fair.
Did you find, in a situation like that, do you try to be objective regarding the two sides, or do you find inevitably you have sympathy?
No, I think in a war in which your own people are not involved, it is very, I won't say very easy, but it is easier to be objective. And after all, that is supposed to be the principal first rule of journalism, that you should be objective, especially in war. I had no axe to grind one way or the other. I felt no lesser compassion for a dead Syrian than I did a dead Israeli, or a dead Jordanian to a dead Egyptian. It was a silly war. I found it, there was no reason why I shouldn't be objective, and I found no emotional, no personal reason why I shouldn't be objective. It's only, I think, when your own people are involved, or you see gross injustice, like the bombing of civilians and children, where you lose and should lose your objectivity and take sides on the side of right. Not on either side of the warmongers, but on the side of what is right and moral. No, to answer your question, quite easy to remain objective then.
During your briefings, would you have been told or given any sort of hints about the strategy?
No. The briefing officers tended to brief you about your area of warfare, the place you were at. I'm sure they themselves didn't know the broader strategy. So what my job was, and what Jerry's job was, and what every individual reporter on the ground there's duty was, job was, simply to report his arena of war that day. And of course what you're doing is reporting a tiny little part of the patchwork quilt. That is what a war is, a huge patchwork quilt, and I report one tiny square of it. Now, I would get upset, and so would Jerry, and so would any reporter who's travelled 11 hours into the desert, to find that all his day's exertions, all his great phrases and all the great pictures only managed to make 2 minutes on air, when you reckon it should have made 10. You were even more aggravated to find out that your 2 minutes was dwarfed by Peter Snow, our diplomatic correspondent, who did 5 or 6 minutes in studio with a great map and great... he had a kind of sand table with all the tanks and everything else on. And, of course, it was only right that that should happen, because Jerry would send a couple of minutes from his Golan, I would send in a couple of minutes from my Sinai. But it was Peter Snow in London who was pulling all the strings from everywhere, from his own briefings with the Foreign Office, with the briefings that were being given in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, briefings being given in Egypt and Jordan and Damascus, for coming in from the agencies. He would then have the broad picture, and he would be able to tell the viewers the broad picture. All we were doing, Jerry and I, people like us, was providing the small cameos, the action, the drama. But it was very necessary, of course, and this has been a style ever since on both the BBC and ITV, that you do need this overview by your defence correspondent or your diplomatic correspondent. So I've no gripes about that, as long as it's done in a clear way, of course. And it does, in a way, it puts us in our place as a war correspondent. But without that overview, we could be giving quite the wrong impression. And that's why it's always, that's why I think foreign correspondents, or anybody come to that, reporting one part of a bigger picture, must not be tempted to make great profound judgments or predictions or assessments. It's very difficult, I mean, it's very dangerous to do that, because you can be overtaken by events or have got it completely wrong. So that's always my advice to the younger guys. Just report what you see. If you want to do a little bit of editorializing, do it in a kind of third division way. Don't imagine you're in top league, because you don't know all that's going on. You really don't. I mean, we were drawn into this during the Bosnian thing, when we were talking about mass graves and mass rape camps. We were so tempted to make great judgmental assessments, which, as it turned out, turned not to be a fact. So, no, it's only right that we provide the drama, we provide the action, we provide the tanks and all the dodging of bullets and the bit on all the hysteria which the viewers love, and which are part of the war, which is the war. But it's only right that there should be an overview, a bird's eye view, and an assessment from a disinterested party. So what, 23rd of October, 73, and that was just after midnight, so the war was over, 17 days, and I suppose one could have been tempted to predict then that, you know, having defeated the Syrians and the Egyptians and the Jordanians and every other Arab who wanted to wage war with Israel, the Israelis had won, and that was the end of it. But there was another Arab factor which had been a festering sore in the Middle East, not just for the Israelis, but for the Arabs too, mostly for the Arabs, I think, and certainly for the rest of the world, and they were called Palestinians. So having defeated all the other Arab nations around them, the Israelis were now faced with the final and what has since been an everlasting enemy, Palestinian liberation movement. They had, as I said earlier to you, they had established themselves in Jordan, and like the cuckoo had tried to kick the other birds out of a nest and ended in the Jordanian civil war. They then went to the Lebanon, and as it happened, did much to the Lebanon as it attempted to do to Jordan. They established their enormous guerrilla training camps there, and it was their policy to put their training camps in the refugee camps. So if the Israelis wanted to attack and destroy their guerrilla camps, it became part and parcel that they would incur enormous civilian casualties too. But that
talking about the training and refugee camps being together.
Yes, well, that's once the Palestinians had decided and were forced to leave Jordan, they established their bases in Lebanon. And as I said, I think the cuckoo is a good example of how they simply moved into a country and attempted to take it over. The Palestinians have always been under the impression that the rest of Arabia is duty bound to help them and go to war even to re-establish Palestine. That is not the way the rest of Arabia feels. In fact, the rest of Arabia, I've always thought, would be delighted if the Palestinians could somehow, you know, just be dropped into the deepest part of the sea. But it wasn't long before retribution, or let's put it another way, the Lebanese paid the penalty of playing hosts to the Palestinians. When I first went to Beirut, it was after the Jordanian Civil War, which I've spoken about already. I went a number of times, usually on my way in and out of Jordan. Because Beirut was a fantastic place then, absolutely fantastic place. It was called the Pearl of Levant. It'd been the centre of trade, you know, for thousands of years. It was an extravagant place. Excuse me. It had that unbelievable Grand Mosque. It had the Bois de Pin, huge avenues of trees that had been planted by some emir to stave off the advance of the desert. It was almost the Paris of the Middle East. You know, it had great sweeping boulevards and esplanades and terrace cafes. It had a very French feel about it. It boasted some of the world's most expensive restaurants, and possibly some of the best occasionally. You know, it had the sea at its feet, and it had, with great marinas, made Nice and Monte Carlo look like a poor man's boatyard. It had fantastic hotels. I remember the hotels. I mean, just in those days, I mean, I was pretty new to expensive hotels, but they were certainly astonishing. And nightclubs. And I think I quipped at the time that Arab princes would go there and would pay the casino's mortgage in one week's losses. You know, expensive cars, beautiful women. And the souk, of course, was world famous. This wonderful thousands of years old souk, little tunnels and alleys and arched shops where, you know, where these rug, buy beautiful rugs there. The rug merchant would tell you that, you know, almost plead with you to make him bankrupt by buying rugs that cost, you know, for less than it costs to produce. I mean, they're the most astonishing people. And they used to say that you could go swimming in Beirut in the morning and go skiing in Beirut in the afternoon. It was that kind of place. So I was one of those unfortunates who had seen it in its splendid days and then witnessed its slow destruction. By the summer of 75, remember, I'd seen it first in 71. Within four years, the destruction of Beirut was complete. It wasn't just the Palestinians fighting the Lebanese. Once the Lebanese had managed to get rid of the Palestinians and push them even further north up towards Gaddafi, the Lebanese decided to fight each other. Yeah, it was the Muslims versus the Christians, the old, old story. I sent a report out of Beirut in June 75, and I reported that the destruction of the old Beirut was complete, that Hotel Row had become, I remember the phrase, a geometrical nightmare with acres of steel girders